It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Washington Post got an internal National Park Service report that details ways construction of the border fence in Arizona could harm some historic sites. First, a new report from the Trust for America's Health says obesity in America is getting worse. The group reported that last year, obesity rates went up in 33 states. In Wisconsin, however, we stayed about the same, with 32% of residents qualifying as obese. Though the trend here has largely been an increase in obesity rates over time, according to the group, the State of Obesity, which is a collaborative project of the Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Dr. George Chip Morris is president of the Wisconsin Medical Society. He's with us today to talk more about the problem of obesity in Wisconsin and to share some suggestions for what can be done to improve it. Dr. Morris, thanks so much for joining us.
Good afternoon, Judith.
How significant is it, hearing those numbers, that the obesity rate in Wisconsin stayed the same last year while it rose in many other states around the country?
Well, we have this ongoing battle with weight and obesity, and it is encouraging that it's not worsening. But when a third of our population actually has a weight that is unhealthy for them and predicts that they'll have future diseases, then we are not where we need to be. And the fact that other states are worsening is just a national disaster. It's a health disaster, it's an economic disaster, and it's a national security disaster.
And we'll get into some of those details in a bit. But first, what do you think accounts for the past rise and the current rate of, as you said, about a third of adults here in Wisconsin falling into the obese category?
Well, there are a number of things that have been attributed to our weight gain. First of all, there has been a move away from physical activity, which was quite a bit more prominent in earlier parts of our life, and a gradual increasing of unhealthy eating behaviors that occur. Our meal sizes have progressively gotten larger. Our plate sizes have actually gotten larger over time, so that the epidemic that we have is really the result of a multifactorial set of issues.
Is part of it then education, of knowing what we really need as far as physical activity, as far as the amount of food or calories in a day that we need to be healthy?
There's no question that understanding the nature of how to manage weight is actually at the heart of all of this. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Task Force for America's Health are just pointing out, again, things that are critical. 10 years ago, the Institute of Medicine published a report on the state of America's weight, and it highlighted many of these same issues, that our system promotes policies that don't address appropriate food and activity levels, that we don't make food, that we don't make health an easy choice for people to choose. And then finally, we really need to design this into the system so everyone benefits, because we see a significant amount of inequity in the effects of obesity.
And I wanted to talk about the inequity in a couple of different ways. One is, these are not percentages that are identical across different social, economic, racial groups. How does that break down demographically?
Well, we actually see fairly striking differences. Men and women have relatively similar rates of obesity, but African Americans and Latinos tend to have obesity rates both, but prominently in women, but of sometimes 20% higher than their white counterparts. And Asian individuals have half of that. So we see disparities in this issue around weight. And we see it socioeconomically. In poor neighborhoods, we see a significantly higher rate of obesity. So it is affecting us. It's affecting us very profoundly, and it's at a great cost.
And let's talk about some of those obesity-related health issues that add to that cost, both the cost to the person who is suffering from them, but also to the cost of providing health care, employment, et cetera. What are some of the most clearly linked health problems that are either caused by or exacerbated by obesity?
Well, the list is so large that it's hard to, we won't have any more time for the rest of the program. Cardiovascular disease, obviously, heart disease is top of the list, hypertension and the health of the heart itself, myocardial infarction are both increased. And as weight increases, we see increasing risks for heart attack and hypertension, diabetes, which is growing in all of our populations, young and old, is escalating rapidly. But now we actually have identified that forms of cancer are associated with obesity. Our issues around healthy reproductive situations, maternal and infant mortality are affected by overweight parents. It's everywhere, and it affects the ability of those individuals to actually maintain their health. And as soon as they start to have those health problems, then they find themselves potentially having more trouble with accessing good health, good health care, and they pull out of the workforce. They stop being part of the economic engine that drives our country's success. And in addition to that, they no longer are able to perform some of the most critical functions that we have, particularly in young people, which is that they no longer are going to qualify to serve in the armed forces or be members of our civil defense. These are far-reaching and very expensive issues.
We're talking with Dr. George Chip Morris right now. He's president of the Wisconsin Medical Society, and we're talking about the issue of obesity in Wisconsin in light of a new report looking at obesity rates in the state and around the country. And I was just thinking, Dr. Morris, are we seeing, how would I say it, a lack of advancement of, say, life expectancy due to these many, many serious health issues that are linked to obesity?
Absolutely. It is entirely likely that the current generation of Americans will actually potentially see shorter lifespans than the current generations and future generations even shorter, because these health issues continue to mount. Obesity is an epidemic. One-third of the country has a condition that we know will make them prone to having a much higher frequency of disease, and a disease that will eventually limit their life, limiting their ability to contribute to society and to successfully have a contribution in the communities that they live in. All these things truncate the ability of our American public to do well. There are estimates now that by 2025, it's possible that only one in four American 17-year-olds would even qualify for selective service based upon their inability to pass the physical requirements. It's catastrophic.
And I want to talk a little bit about those young people, even younger than those that would be registering for selective service. What do we know about obesity rates in children?
This, of course, has been a major focus for all along, because we actually do recognize that early obesity actually leads to an entire lifetime of obesity. That the fat cells in our body are not yet necessarily developed. They remain as stem cells, undifferentiated fat cells. And that when we feed them, it is that stimulus that actually creates an actual fat cell. And to actually reduce that fat cell's size, you have to literally starve it. It won't go away. It's still going to be there. So addressing childhood obesity becomes particularly important. And those efforts have to start, you know, even in preschoolers, because we see the children now developing diabetes at a very alarming rate in young individuals. Our obesity rate just two decades ago was half what it is in our 10 to 17 year old kids, and that group only continues on to have those health problems as adults, and their lives are truncated by it.
We're talking to Dr. George Chip Morris. He's president of the Wisconsin Medical Society, and we're discussing obesity in Wisconsin. We've been talking a lot about the costs, and we'll start looking at some solutions in just a bit. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Has obesity impacted your life or that of a loved one? What questions or comments do you have about what individuals, schools, doctors, or the government can do about this obesity epidemic? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the public health impact of obesity in Wisconsin. Dr. George L. Morris is president of the Wisconsin Medical Society and is with us to discuss challenges we face and possible solutions. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What experiences have you had with obesity, either yourself or someone close to you? What would you like to see done by government when it comes to bringing Wisconsin's obesity rate back down? Do you see other solutions that you think should be tried? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go to the phones, and Owen in Wyoega is up first. Hi, Owen.
Hi. Hi, Judith. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share one of my personal experiences here with what I found was I started looking at what I was eating, and I found anything that came out of a box, a package, or most restaurant foods even, you find a lot of added sugar. So I tried to stay away from anything with added sugar, and I just miraculously lost 10 pounds. I didn't really change my other eating habits. I didn't cut out fat and other things like that. But what I was really surprised to find, I was reading all this information, we're importing all kinds of sugar from other countries into this country, and the amount of fertilizer that the sugar cane responds to when it's growing, it really yields well the more fertilizer you use. So there's a ton of synthetic, chemically engineered fertilizers going into sugarcane.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, Owen, so Dr. Morris can respond to that. I'm not sure, Dr. Morris, if you can address the agricultural issue there, but
sure.
But the issue of added sugar.
Absolutely. Owen really points out an incredibly important part about what we need to do. The Medical Society drafted a policy on obesity many years ago, which is, I think, still very current in the sense that it really enforces the need for nutritional labeling. And the more labeling that we can do, the better. One of the things that he's learned and he's benefited from is the labeling that says how many sugars are in his products. And in fact, those sugars represent calories, but they represent no calories with no additional benefit. And the society recommends that we do more labeling and that we avoid foods and food types that are associated with that added sugar. So nutritional labeling is a big part of what the TFAH and Robert Wood Johnson really recommended that we do to make healthy choices easy for people. And, you know, Judith, in fairness, you know, I did search on your site for the article that you had described about obesity before our program today. And after I found the article, the two next things that it recommended to me were a recipe for cookies and a recipe for cake from America's Test Kitchen. I think of the world of America's Test Kitchen, but lots of added sugar in that process. And so better nutritional labeling, better food and beverage marketing are key parts of helping that part that Owen actually identifies as so important.
Let's go back to the phones, and Marcus in Madison, I think, has a point that goes right along with that. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Ms. Sears-Poisson and Dr. Morris. I think it has to be pointed out that one of the greatest offenders in this state in media of promoting the kinds of food that feature no nutrition, lots of fat, eating as entertainment is WPR. You can't go 2 hours on WPR without hearing about food. An hour devoted to how to make cheese on the grill and the ice cream museum, and it just goes on and on.
And Marcus pointing out that there is it's hard to avoid talking about or seeing advertising or praise in some cases of a variety of foods that might be best enjoyed in extreme moderation. Dr. Morris.
Right. And it's a absolutely fair point that we are still in obviously a transition, but we need to start to move forward. Actually, program that I listened to recently on public radio talked about including ginger in meals, and so that you didn't have to include as many sugars, because the ginger was actually satisfying some of those needs. But it's not just that. It's that we have to actually make sure that nutrition is available. There's not a level playing field out there for nutritional foods, and we have to find systems that will actually assist with that, to actually level that out, so that those disparities where we have poverty and race influencing obesity start to be diminished over time.
Let's talk about some of the Wisconsin Medical Society's policy proposals for preventing and treating obesity in both children and adults. One that I think might not be at the top of people's minds is the physical activity environment, not just amount of physical activity, but the environment in which we are moving. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Judith, while that isn't obvious, it is so critical. Land design so that there are safe spaces, there are functional spaces for people to use for physical activity is so crucial, and it has to start early. Safe to school projects where children have an easy way to use their legs and walk and use physical activity to be getting to school. I know that the Bicycle Federation, for instance, sponsors programs to help children bicycle safely to school. Those sort of safe to school programs that the CDC has put together target children with obesity risk factors, with that not only their nutrition but their physical activity. Those are things that, from a things we can do standpoint, really have to come farther forward to the front. And in fact, our Safe Streets approval here in Wisconsin that went through the legislature is an example of that. Promoting cities that actually create safe environments for people to be physically active is exactly the kind of policy that we need to enhance, make more common, so that people get out and do things.
We're talking with Dr. George Morris, president of the Wisconsin Medical Society, about dealing with and addressing the obesity crisis here in Wisconsin. And Dr. Morris, it can, I think, sometimes feel overwhelming when you see those huge numbers of people, adults and children, dealing with obesity. But some things are working. There was a decline in obesity rates among 2 to 4 year olds who were participating in the WIC program. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, the Women and Children's Program that provides early life nutrition for children is able to provide that in a way that actually meets some of these recently adopted standards. The special milk program that provides skim milk for children so as not to promote additional unneeded calories. That the school lunch and breakfast programs make sure that children are actually receiving meals that will actually help support them nutritionally so their health is continued. And really an important one and very poignant here in Wisconsin is the farm-to-school program. So all of those programs in childhood nutrition are fairly key and really important in making sure that those early years form a basis for healthy eating. And then we need to actually be able to do that over the long term because, you know, we still need to be healthy eaters when we're older, too, because obesity climbs throughout our life and then actually slows down in late adulthood. But it is very common in the middle portion of our years.
Briefly, as we wrap up, are you hopeful on this issue?
I'm absolutely hopeful that we identify these issues. I would like to see large-scale, bigger changes. And one of them that we pointed out at the Medical Society and was published in the Wisconsin Medical Journal is that many physicians suffer without having a very clear or without having a pathway to actually provide help for people who are obese. That our physicians, when polled, found that at least a third of them had no really clear direction where they could actually get a structured medical service. So to move forward in this whole process, I think I'm hopeful we'll get larger investments.
Dr. Morris, thanks so much for joining us. That's Dr. George Chip Morris, president of the Wisconsin Medical Society. We talked with him today about Wisconsin's obesity rate and policy proposals for how to improve the public health problem. President Trump was in San Diego yesterday talking to reporters along a section of wall being built along the U.S.-Mexico border. Trump has said he wants to have 500 miles of wall or fence constructed by next year's fall election. Environmental advocates and private landowners have been among those protesting the project. And a new group raising concerns is within the government itself. It's the National Park Service. According to a report obtained by the Washington Post, a section of wall planned for Arizona could have impacts on a national monument there. Juliet Eilprin is senior national affairs correspondent for the Washington Post and co-authored the story on this report. Juliet, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much.
You report this document from the National Park Service was for internal government purposes. Do you know who the intended audience was?
Well, really, it was a combination of it was the audience of primarily Customs and Border Patrol and the Department of Homeland Security in the sense that it was essentially staffers at the National Park Service doing an analysis of what could be at risk now, as construction is starting along the border. And ideally, this is supposed to inform the decisions that are made going forward on where and how to build the border barriers that are now underway as of late last month.
When was this report compiled?
The research for it was done in June. The report was finalized in July, and later this month, any day now, there are archaeological experts that will go back into the field in this area at the Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument because they're still trying to identify what are some of the vulnerable archaeological sites in the area where construction is planned.
So describe for us the land that we're talking about, as you said, the Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument.
Sure. This is a huge, over 300,000, 330,000 acres of wilderness in the Sonoran Desert. It's extremely dry, which is partially why these sites, which date back thousands of years, have remained intact. It's an internationally recognized biosphere because it has some incredibly rare and diverse plants, including plenty of cacti, which is how it has its name, but also it basically has a desert oasis in it, Quito Springs, and that has sustained some very rare species, including a kind of mud turtle and pupfish.
And so there are obviously, it sounds like, environmental concerns as well, but from this archaeological point of view, what do we know about who the previous residents of this area were?
Yeah, that's a great question. So essentially, there are more than a dozen tribes that, you know, suggest that they have some connection to this area. There was a basically, as I mentioned, there was this prehistoric trade route called the Old Salt Trail, and essentially you had many of these desert-dwelling people would travel, through this area and gain sustenance. And as a result, you have some really, you have some really incredible archaeological sites, and particularly the Tonohono Odum Nation used to inhabit a large swath of this desert on both the Mexican and U.S. side. And so they're among the, tribes that, for example, have the closest connection because their ancestors lived there between roughly 200 and 1400 AD.
And has there been extensive archaeological research and digs done there already, or is this a site that still has a lot of potential?
It definitely has potential. There has been, research dating back, decades, and certainly some of these areas have been identified both on this national monument and there's an adjoining National Wildlife Refuge, which is also slated for border barrier construction. So while there has been some research done, part of what's happening right now is that, frankly, there has not been a comprehensive study of this area right on the U.S.-Mexico border. And because President Trump has outlined an accelerated schedule for the border wall construction, that's why we see this, kind of scramble to identify as many artifacts and sites as possible right now.
We're talking with Juliet Eilprin. She's Senior National Affairs Correspondent for The Washington Post. We're talking about potential archaeological damage that could be done by construction of the southern border wall. And let's talk about that wall or that fence. Juliet, what kind of damage could be caused by that construction?
Well, there are a couple things. So they're converting what is a kind of 5 to 6 foot high vehicle barrier to a 30 foot barrier, which is obviously most significant. But what the real risk of damage is that there's a road that that runs alongside this barrier, which is obviously traversed by, for example, Border Patrol vehicles for all-terrain vehicles and so forth. And they're talking about tripling the width of this road. And that certainly is one of the areas where you could have some damage because you're really, going into an area where there are sites. And so there's that. There's also simply the fact that you do have these all-terrain vehicles that are driving, sometimes in pursuit of folks who are crossing the border illegally. And in the course of doing that, there is, already has certainly been some, vehicle traffic over places where there are archaeological sites.
And you mentioned that there are current Native American tribes who reside in the area and who have connections to these ancient people, including, you mentioned the Tohono O'odham tribe, which is right there. Do they have any standing to challenge this?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, under normal procedures, they would have been consulted. There would have been a kind of extensive process of consultation with this tribe. But there's a 2005 law that allows the Department of Homeland Security to waive a slew of requirements, including those kinds of consultations, a law on historic preservation, one on archaeological preservation, and so as a result, there, it seems like it would be an uphill battle, and certainly environmental groups have sought to block construction of this barrier and have failed so far to do that.
How significant is it that these concerns are coming from within the government, from the National Park Service, as opposed to the significant number of outside groups or private citizens who have been in opposition?
Right. There's certainly, I think, people generally associate findings, by a government agency with greater authority, given that it is presumably to some extent, it's seen as more impartial than what you have from an outside group. In addition, these are the experts who, have worked in this area for some time and are certainly most familiar with what's happening, as well as, it does show that the federal government is not a monolith, and that there are, particularly when you're talking about career civil servants, who might have different views. And this is actually, how the government is supposed to work. In a lot of these cases, the National Park Service, weighs in on something that's happening on its own land as well as, nearby federal land. And so and we see this, and sometimes these kinds of assessments play a critical role in decision making.
Well, Juliet, thanks so much for joining us and bringing us up to speed.
Thank you.
Juliet Eilprin is Senior National Affairs Correspondent for The Washington Post. We talked to her today about a National Park Service report that she wrote about that raised concerns about building the border wall in a particular area of Arizona with archaeological artifacts. A proposal to bring new F-35 fighter jets to a Wisconsin National Guard base in Madison has been the subject of intense focus and debate in recent months. Supporters of the plan say the new jets will bring jobs and make it less likely that the base will be closed in the future. But many residents living near Truax Field have big concerns over noise from the jets and what it will do to their property values. Now, Representative Mark Pocan is calling for more testing to be done before the plan is approved. Pocan is a Democratic member of Congress representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. He's also co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and he joins us now. Representative Pocan, good to have you back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can you remind us what jets are currently stationed at Truax Field on the northeast side of Madison?
Yeah, the F-16 is the current jet that's at Truax.
And what kind of activities do they engage in there? What's their mission?
Well, I think the real question is at this point, what's happening to that plane? And it's a plane that's being phased out, which is why the F-35 is being considered at Truax to begin with. So, just as the military or any business would do, you eventually change out the product, or in this case, to a different class of plane. That is what I think we're facing. If you would lose the F-16s completely, question would be, how long would you keep the base, the 115th National Guard unit there? And that's the real pivotal issue.
And so these F-35 fighter jets, these squadrons, are being considered for placement at Truax. What's the process for where they will be eventually placed?
Sure. It's one of these great long and convoluted government military processes that takes years. I think through this process, they've narrowed it down to 5 locations, of which they're going to go to 2 of them. And Wisconsin, I think, based on scoring and whatever panels they had, is one of the top 2 that they're looking at right now. So it's in a place that it could be likely they will bring F-35s there. I think the question we have right now is just, what does it mean to have an F-35 versus an F-16? And if you don't have an F-35, potentially what happens to the 115th that's currently there? That is a much, 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 much bigger footprint than just the footprint for either the F-16 or the F-35.
And for people who aren't familiar with Truax Field in Madison, that part of the city, can you describe what the location is like?
Yeah, it's really attached to, I guess you'd say, the Dane County Airport. But the overall economic aspect of the 115th, having the National Guard there, having what's currently there, I think, is something like $100 million to the local community. So it's a pretty significant footprint that exists in Dane County. And for quite a while, they've had F-16s, which, you know, when I've been out to the airport, you can hear they're very loud, especially when you're right underneath them. But it's something that has been operational there for quite a while. With the military moving the planes out, that's why they're considering this new plane. And I think the real question we have is because around the airport in Dane County, while there are some areas that don't have housing, there's certainly other areas that do. And the flight patterns that come in cover more neighborhoods in Madison, especially on the north and east sides, so that more people will be affected by a plane than maybe are in the direct proximity of the airport itself.
And so what are you hearing from constituents about this proposed F-35 program?
Yeah, so we're hearing a little bit of both. I mean, a lot of people are concerned about the economic impact if we would lose the current footprint, which is that 100 million base because of the 115th being there. But then there are other people, especially in the neighborhoods around it, concerned about what this means to noise levels and frequency of flights, et cetera. I think what got really confusing was when the environmental impact statement came out. It was written by bureaucrats, and it sounds very bureaucratic. So, for example, one of the things they say is that 1,000 homes will be incompatible with residential use. That's not language people use,
right.
But we don't really know what that means, and we're trying to get answers to just that. Also, the number of flights seems to be a little more than I think they had originally said because they were going to use flight simulators, so we're trying to get answers on that. What they did in many ways is I think they provided us with more questions than answers, and that's why we've had already one public hearing for the community, and there's going to be another one coming up. I believe it's on the 27th, but we're just trying to get simple answers. And then most recently, we came up with, I think, what's the simplest of solution of all, which is when you read a report, it's hard to understand what sound is from reading. Not exactly a great translation. So if a picture is worth 1,000 words, I think in this case, a plane is worth 1,000 words. And if we could have an F-35 fly-in following an F-16 or vice versa, there can be a comparison of what the actual sound differences would be for the community. And to me, that would be the simplest and most fair way to actually assess this rather than lots of us trying to decide what a bureaucrat meant when they wrote incompatible with residential use.
We're talking with Representative Mark Pocan right now. He's a member of Congress representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. He's also co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And Representative Pocan, have you been in touch with the Air Force? As you said, you and others have more questions now, maybe even than earlier. Have you been in touch with the Air Force directly?
Yeah, we sent them a letter a few weeks back on frequency of flights and noise. I think we've sent them an email with a few other questions people had about whether nuclear warheads would be housed there, which I don't think they will. I'm quite sure they won't, but we still wanted to get a definitive answer. And then I think we still have, you know, questions on like the language that we've sent to them about what does 1,000 homes incompatible, what does that exactly mean? And then most recently we wrote to them about, you know, trying to do this test flight, because again, I think that's the most practical, pragmatic way for people to really understand what this means, because I don't know after reading that report exactly what the sound level means. And I think, you know, having a plane in would make the most sense. So we're trying to get some answers out of that. I think because we have an ability to maybe get answers more than the average person, we're hoping that they'll respond soon. But as of yet, we don't have responses on any of the communications we've had.
Have there been previous concerns about noise levels from the Truax field before this F-35 topic has come up?
I think there's probably always been a little bit, you know, off and on, but there has been a footprint of the F-16 there for quite a while. So I think the real question, again, that many of us are looking at is if they're going to go there, and I think, you know, they'll make that decision regardless of what I and others think, quite honestly. They're doing it based on their own assessment. What does it really mean? You know, if you have 1,000 homes, for example, that suddenly are going to lose value, That would be a huge concern to me, and I think it should be to everyone. You know, the single biggest investment you have in your life for most people is your home, and if that suddenly decreases value because of sound issues or because you're suddenly in a map that says you have sound issues, and they're not going to provide any assistance, which is, again, part of the questions we're asking, then that would be a very, very big concern. So we're just trying to get more answers, which I think, you know, the public deserves, and we're hoping that they'll do it in an expeditious manner.
As you noted, there's a final environmental impact study still to come from the Air Force. Other than noise, are there other issues that you are going to be looking for more information on in that?
I mean, we've always had some issues around PFAS, but that's an issue around the country. That's a chemical that's used in putting out fires and especially used in this area with airplanes. And that's a whole separate issue, but being dealt with by a lot of members of Congress because it runs across all districts. It's not unique to this one situation. But mainly right now, I think that's that. And there are some people who, quite honestly, just don't want the F-35, period. And what I have told them is, while I never have voted for funding for an F-35, that has passed Congress. So the fight really isn't on stopping F-35s from being built, because that's already been passed. It's from whether or not they're going to be placed in our communities and what impact that has.
And speaking of impact, there is, as you noted, an economic impact to the positive of having some of these activities, these bases here. Supporters of this, including your Democratic colleague, Senator Tammy Baldwin, say that these F-35s could bring more jobs to the area and also make it more likely that the Air Force wouldn't shut down the Truax base. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I think the F-35 specifically is about 55 to 60 full-time equivalent jobs. But it's the broader issue, I think, that most people are watching, which is that $100 million of impact of having the 115th there. And if you didn't have a plane that they could use because they're phasing out the F-16s, would that still be there? You know, my hope is that if we realize that for some reason F-35s won't be coming, that we would still be able to keep the 115th. And I think, you know, looking forward without a crystal ball, you know, if there was a Democratic president and having a Democratic representative and a Democratic senator, hopefully we would be in a better position to find some other ways to keep it in our community, because that does have a huge economic impact.
And before we let you go, Representative Pokin, Democrats had their first impeachment hearing this week in the House, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was reportedly very critical of it, saying Democrats don't have the votes for impeachment. Do you still think this is the right move for your party?
Yeah, I think talking about impeachment now is like looking at a seed and deciding how much you're going to get for how big the pumpkin is. You don't really know that yet, right? For right now, we're just trying to get witnesses to come to talk about the charges of the Mueller report, for example, the 10 possible charges of obstruction. The problem is the president, who claims he's innocent, is not allowing people to come and testify. So short of starting the impeachment investigation, which has been started, we don't have the legal means to bring these witnesses to compel them to come to Congress. I use the Wisconsin smell test. You know, if I'm really innocent, like the president claims, I would be giving these people a ride to the testimony. I give them a big bottle of water so their voice is really clear as they proclaim his innocence. And the fact that he's not doing that, again, doesn't pass the smell test. But for us, legally, what we have is an impeachment investigation that's now been opened that gives us extra tools to get witnesses to come. And it's my constitutional duty to at least explore that and see what happens. So getting way farther ahead on whether or not there's an impeachment vote is, I think, the wrong conversation.
Well, Representative Pocan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
That was Representative Mark Pocan, a member of Congress representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. He's a Democrat, and he is also the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. He was with us today to talk about why he says there needs to be more noise testing before a plan to bring F-35 fighter jets to a base in Madison, whether that gets approval from the Air Force or not. The deadline for public comments is September 27th. And again, the Air Force is going to be choosing two sites in the country. so cute when the little ones learn to play hide and seek, isn't it? They figure out where they can go to avoid being spotted and squeal with delight when they are or when they find their playmates. You might think I'm talking about young kids, but I'm not. In fact, this is a story about rats. It turns out that German researchers have learned that not only can rats be taught how to play hide and seek, they actually enjoy it and will try to keep the game going longer than it needs to. And they aren't just good at hiding, which you would think seems like a good survival technique that they would have already, but they can also change roles and then try to find the researchers. The researchers used rewards with the rats, which they said included hand chasing, stroking, patting, and tickling. What really surprised them was that the rats seemed to enjoy the game so much that they would actually delay getting their rewards just to be able to play longer. Again, that sounds a lot like kids who want to keep playing even though it's time to come in for dinner. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then Midwest Express Airlines is making a comeback almost 10 years after going out of business. We'll find out how different the new Midwest will be and if passengers can still expect those warm chocolate chip cookies. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.